Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, I'm joined by author Victoria N. Alexander. She's written a new novel that deals with 9/11. It's called Locus Amenus. Victoria Alexander has a PhD in English and philosophy of science, and is also a novelist and the founder of Dactyl, a foundation that fosters dialogue between artists and scientists. Locus Amenus is set in Amenia, New York, and relates the story of a modern-day Hamlet whose father died in 9/11 and who starts to investigate the final collapse of the buildings. Hamlet starts to go crazy when his former science teacher, Horatio from Brooklyn, tells him that things are not as they seem regarding the collapse of the buildings that killed his father. Locus Amenus is a dark comedy that revolves around the tragedy of 9/11 and rural life in Amenia, New York. Victoria Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, maybe you could tell us to start with when and why you got interested in 9/11 and questioning the official account, and then we can get into why you wrote the book.
Well, I have a friend, Tom Breidenbach, who submitted one of the four dust samples collected for the dust analysis, which found evidence of nanothermite. Tom's friend collected it, gave it to Tom, and then Tom turned it in. Tom is a poet, and I was not interested in politics at all. I was a director of an arts foundation in Soho, and Tom Breidenbach was one of the poets that we worked with regularly. And so I learned that he had collected this or submitted this dust sample, and I got this paper and read it. I'm also a philosopher of science, so I'm used to reading scientific papers, and I found it was well argued, well presented. The evidence was all there, and I started to look into more and started asking questions, had lunch with Tom, found out what was going on. This was all in 2009 or 10 or something like that, so I learned about it really late.
That's great, though. I find people who come on later now have more energy than some of the older people.
Yeah.
Okay, so that got you involved in and interested, and what he was saying made sense to you. And then what motivated you to write the book?
Well, the book begins with some small-town corruption involving some healthy food in the cafeteria. You know, the school board was not handling the situation right. And I was involved in that kind of thing in my small town where I live upstate. And then I ran into Tom at about the same time, and in a writer's life, things tend to overlap in their minds. And it seemed to me that the small-town corruption and just the lazy way that people don't address problems or bother to read any information or look into things, try to think carefully about things, you know, that was all very present in my mind, and there was a real problem locally. And I got to thinking that at the global level or at the federal level, you know, things are just as messed up for the public, you know, trying to learn about what's going on. People are just lazy, distracted. And so the themes just started to come together.
So you're writing from personal experience as well as what you know about 9/11. And is the pronunciation of your book, is it called Locus Amenus?
In Latin, it can sound like locus amenus. In English, when people have used that word at all, if they do, they usually say locus amenus or locus amenus. And I really did myself in picking an unpronounceable title for my book, but it has significance. In pastoral poetry, it's the place where nothing bad can ever happen. And of course, it is the place where terrible things happen. And also the name of the town in which the story is based is Amenia, which is from the same word as Locus Amenus.
I actually found the book interesting because I had just recently been through Amenia, New York, and saw the Wissahick train station. And
oh.
It was all come up in the books. And I hadn't been out there in years, so it was kind of serendipitous. So tell me a bit about why you chose to write the book Locus Amenus, paralleling it to Hamlet, Shakespeare's Hamlet.
Well, Hamlet is one of my favorite plays. For some reason, I watch it all the time. I don't really know why. And I had been watching David Tennant's version of Hamlet with the Royal Shakespeare Company. David Tennant went on to be Doctor Who. And he's just a wonderful actor, and he makes the role so funny. He plays it like Doctor Who. If you know the Doctor Who character, that's how he plays Hamlet.
Okay.
And Hamlet is a young, angry, confused, sad, in love person, and David Tennant just did such a good job. And whenever I write a book, I'm always searching for the voice, because I usually write in first person, and I was looking for the voice for that, and suddenly that voice came to me, and so I just went with it. And it was important to me to, since this is just so absurdly tragic, this whole thing, it has gone beyond confusing. And, you know, I think most of us who understand what's going on have gone way beyond anger. We're just, like, kind of giddy with just how absurd it is. And so I wanted to speak with a character's voice who was just embracing the kind of craziness and able to laugh at it, even though it's very, very sad. So it was the voice that I started with first, and then once a writer does something like that, then the parallels seem to just fall into place, and it seems to work really well. You know, there's something is rotten in the state of Denmark. That's how Hamlet begins, and that's how my book begins, too. Something's rotten in the United States of America.
Well, I was really impressed with how you could take such a sad and depressing topic as 9/11 and turn it into something that was sort of humorous as well as dark, but you managed to combine
it. Sounds horrible when you say that. You know? It sounds like I've written this comedy about 9/11, you know, but it's gallows humor, you know, when things are really, really terrible. If you've ever been in a really stressful situation, you know, if there's a death in the family or something, you know, the humor kicks in for some reason. It's sort of a defense mechanism we have or something like that. But yeah, a lot of the reaction with all of the readers so far is they find it hysterical. You know, they laugh until they cry. And
is the book already released, or when will it be released?
I just heard from the publisher yesterday that it's been released on Kindle as of yesterday, and the hardcover will be out on June 12th.
Oh, that's great news. You have a lot of references in the book to sheep, and the two main characters, Gertrude and Hamlet, mother and son, are raising sheep. And then the villain in the story is named Carlyle Hogg. And so I wonder if you could talk about how you chose to use sheep and hogs in this.
Well, Hogg, because he's very obese, that name came to me. Carlyle for the Carlyle Group, which is the intelligence corporation owned partly by the Bush family. You know, Bush family are on the board in the Bin Laden family.
Right. And how about the sheep?
Well, Hamlet comes to the realization that there's not a lot you can do to fight a system that's completely broken. You try to work with the system. It is the system. You have to wait for the system to collapse on its own. And the only alternative is just to try to take care of yourself, not buy all the crap that they want us to buy, and live on a small farm, you know, turn to sustainable practices, and tried not to feed the beast so much. That's about the only thing we can do. And so the sheep represent that return to agricultural life.
Oh, okay. So I was interpreting them as, because in the book they do this, just doing whatever you're told, following along, not questioning, you know, being sheep.
Yes. Well, there is a few references to that, to the sheeple idea. It's a big problem in the education system that we have in the United States. Both private and public tend to produce sheep. Although I don't want to denigrate those four-legged animals too much because they're really wonderful.
You are actually, you raise them yourself, right?
Yes, I actually have sheep, yes, and they're wonderful creatures.
And now I'm going to read a passage from page 159 in the book and ask a question about that. It starts with Hamlet, the son, talking about 9/11. And here goes. They blew up, Mom. The buildings blew up. They knew the planes were coming. They let it happen. And they were ready with their pyrotechnics.
might as well take full advantage. They couldn't be satisfied with damaged buildings or hundreds dead. They wanted them to go gloriously down. They wanted something big.
And so I was wondering.
And you're thinking that the government let this happen, let 9/11 happen, as opposed to making it happen?
I don't know, and Hamlet doesn't know. And I don't think we will ever know for certain. So this is the scene where Hamlet confronts his mother. And in the play, it's in the closet where he's finally, after not saying anything to her, he's finally confronting her. And he's discovered that his sample that he collected has been tested for nanothermite. So he knows that someone brought the buildings down, wanted them to come down. And I've spent most of my time since I was introduced to these issues through the scientific analysis of the dust and the controlled demolition theories. I've spent most of my time looking at those things and reading the NIST report and haven't spent as much time wondering about who might have done it and why. Some players that come to mind immediately, it appears to me, are the intelligence corporations like Carlyle Group and Booz Allen Hamilton. And there's another character in the book called Booz, named after that, and also Stratford, too.
Oh, I must have missed the Booz reference.
Well, I hid them. I didn't want to be very heavy-handed. He also owns a liquor store, so.
And now I want to ask you about these two characters in this story. They're both friends of Hamlet, although very different from Hamlet. And their names are Guildenstern and Rosencrantz.
And I'm just curious to know why you chose those characters and what they mean in the story.
Well, they are the hapless characters, friends of Hamlet in Shakespeare's play, who kind of get caught up in all the intrigue, and they get used by the court to try to manipulate Hamlet and get information out of him. And in the end, they end up dead. And they're just ignorant victims of corruption and intrigue. So that's how I use them in my book too. You know, they're products of a really bad American education. They've been taught to fill in the bubbles on the standardized test, and they can't think beyond the multiple choice answers that they've been given. It's just impossible for them to do so. And so they have funny names. No one really knows why they're named Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in Shakespeare's play, but they're just the victims of this society and this government.
Yeah, they really seem like pathetic characters.
Yeah, not entirely innocent, because if you allow yourself to just go along with everything and you never ask any questions, then you assume some responsibility for your fate.
Now, did you have any trouble getting the book published, or any reaction because of the topic of 9/11 and questioning?
I did not. I went with the same publisher that I have gone with before. They've published two other novels of mine. And so it's easy entry because they already know me. The topic didn't bother them. My publisher asked me after we signed the contract, he said, "Is that thing about the nanothermite true?" And I said, "Well, you know, that paper does exist. You can read it." So it was really the story, and the conspiracy theorist is a character in contemporary society, and it's time that he appears in literature. So it didn't bother them, and it's not bothering any readers either and reviewers. Not at all. People are not upset by it.
Really?
Really. People who you would think would start doing the gatekeeper thing, like, "Oh, no, we don't think about 9/11 that way," are not doing that at all. They're just accepting it as a general story of political corruption, and they generally believe that whatever happened on 9/11, it wasn't investigated properly, and they've just sort of tried to brush it away, and we have all this, these endless wars as direct result, and they're certainly opportunists, if nothing else. I think few people question that. So it's been accepted relatively easily, except for the one or two people. They don't reject it. They believe it ridicules the conspiracy theorist.
Really? How so? I didn't see that.
I know. There was one reviewer who described Hamlet as somebody who was really led a sheltered life and hardly knew anything because he didn't watch the news enough. And he was ill-informed because he hadn't watched the news. Thought that the whole book was criticizing someone like Hamlet who could be so naive as to think that he could read a scientific report and understand it. I don't know. It's amazing to me, but there hasn't been a reaction to the book like, oh, it's a truther book. I don't want to read it. Nobody's done that.
That's great to hear. Maybe things are changing.
Maybe.
Or maybe it's a testament to your reputation and the work that you do. A lot of people have written books about 9/11 that aren't really writers, and it really shows in yours that you really have a talent for writing. So it's really a great book to read.
I try to ease people into it. The 9/11 issues don't really come up in a strong way until you're halfway through the book. And by that time, you've already gotten to know Hamlet, and you already care about him. And so the most important drama for me of the book is when he tries to tell his friends and family what he's learned from Horatio about the dust sample, they ridicule him and make fun of him and how crushing that is to suddenly be treated with such disrespect by your good friends and your family. And it's just heartbreaking. And we've all had that experience ourselves.
Right.
I have had colleagues that I just mentioned, oh, did you hear about this paper? And to be completely brushed off, it's heartbreaking. So that's the experience that I wanted to bring to my readers so that they understand what it feels like to be delivered this kind of news and to have to live with it.
Right, and we've all experienced that. If anyone who's involved in the 9/11 truth movement has certainly had that experience more than once.
So. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the mother, Gertrude, and, you know, she lost her husband in the towers. She has this son now who's getting into this. What do you see as her role in the novel?
She's a good woman. I think of her as a good Democrat. She's always involved in every committee trying to improve things. She's an activist, a volunteer. She's a great mom. She's a little busy. Maybe when Hamlet was a child, she didn't pay enough attention to him. And she's kind of a workaholic, and she didn't really grieve enough when her husband died, and she just worked to forget about it. And so she is sort of symbolic of, you know, all the good people. She's not like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. She's not ignorant of what happened because she just doesn't ask the right questions. She is just distracted by her own agenda, political agenda or whatever, and she's a smart woman. She's not uneducated, but she just isn't emotionally deep enough to question it, is afraid to question. And it's hard for her.
Yeah, she seemed a little bit on the shallow side, slightly.
Mostly because she's in denial, like so many people are.
Right. Now, have you found that the book, you mentioned a little bit of this, but your friends, we talked about how some people will shun you when you get into talking about 9/11, but have you found that the book has turned people's minds around, anybody, concerning 9/11?
I would say so. Friends didn't want to talk about that nanothermite paper at all. They did not want to talk about that at all. But they love the book. And yes, there have been a couple of people who've, you know, turned about face completely. It's different when you feel it, when you get into the character, when you become someone who is a conspiracy theorist. You know, that's what fiction does. It creates empathy, and you feel what it's like to go through it and to learn this information. And I didn't get into any of the details of the 9/11 anomalies or things, the evidence, really. I just stuck with the fact that NIST never tested for explosives. And they never examined or tried to investigate how the towers fell down. Most people think that that big, thick report must have investigated how the towers collapsed. But in fact, they never did. They only investigated the plane damage and speculated that the damage caused the damaged sections to begin to lean over. And then they stopped their investigation, so they never explained why the block of 15 or so stories in 30 and 1 caused the rest of the buildings to fall down. And that's shocking to me, as someone who's used to reading science. You know, they didn't do any science. It's shocking.
And most people don't know that.
Yeah. So I stayed away from all the controversial issues of who did it and why and whatnot. And just stuck to the fact that if you can verify it, if you read the government reports yourself, that they didn't investigate how the towers fell down and they didn't test for explosives.
Yeah, if you just get that much, then you know something's wrong. It's great.
Something appears to be wrong.
Yeah. Definitely.
And the people who wrote the report, I make Claudius the NIST bureaucrat in the story who marries Gertrude. I make him just a low-level bureaucrat who probably just did what he was told. He worked on one small area of the structure and probably never realized that there was nobody working on the real question. And then they signed off on the report, and it came out, and maybe he looked at it and said that they never did the investigation. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
But you don't have to have a lot of people actively being corrupt and actively continuing to cover up this crime. It will just happen. People are not very good at their jobs. They kind of tend to look the other way. They don't ask any questions.
Or they're discouraged. There's a culture in their office that they're discouraged from that, or they work on a need-to-know basis.
They work on a need-to-know basis,
yeah.
And they just don't want to get involved because they've seen what happened to somebody else that got involved. And my initial thought about conspiracy theories before I read anything about it was, oh, the government's too stupid to pull off an orchestrated thing. And, you know, I probably said that because I'd heard that somewhere, and in my mind I was just repeating it, because that's what we do when we don't want to think about things. We just take some handy phrase and we use that to think for us. But now I realize it doesn't take a lot of organization, and it doesn't take a lot of people pulling the strings all the time. You know, all these gatekeepers, people go along with it anyway. People who are not conspirators help cover it up. You know, they have no idea.
Let me ask you, how has being aware of 9/11 and that we've been lied to, how has that changed your life, or has it?
Well, yes. I mean, I was never political before, not really at all. You know, I was only interested in local environmental issues or something like that. And now I am involved. I watch politics. I know enough to know that there's nothing we can do with our political system. And, you know, I taught myself how to grow my own food.
Right, so you're saying the way to defeat the system is to step out of it. And
to opt out.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I live in a community which a lot of people are doing that, you know. And in my novel, I talk about this town further north called Poland, where they have their own currency, and they use all sustainable energy, and they recycle everything, and they do everything just right. You know, it's a mythical town. It doesn't exist, but it's a goal, I think, that we could strive for, because what else are we going to do? I think we might become depressed if we...
if we don't have any options at all.
Go cultivate your garden. That's what Voltaire said, and that's what we can do. Keep us from going mad.
Well, Victoria, we're almost out of time. Is there anything you would like to talk about or say to the listeners that we haven't already discussed?
Sort of wanted to talk about the ending, because some people have interpreted it, but I don't want to give it away.
That's why I didn't ask about that, but if there
I think I'll just leave it, because it is so powerful the way the book ends. But I'll let you know that the one or two people who are, let's say, faithers as opposed to a truther, believe what they read in the paper, which is just astounding to me that after this story has been told, you would believe what you read in the paper.
Yeah, I think if Americans could take one thing away, is that you just can't believe anything you read or see on the TV news.
If you've ever been in the paper, you know this. You know, if you've ever been interviewed or something and they've written your words out or something, it's always different from your reality. So, you know, people have their own interpretation of things, and that's always true. And when it's a political issue, it's doubly so.
Yes, absolutely. But even the ending of your book was done in a very humorous way.
But I won't give it away. If people want to know that ending, they're going to need to get a copy of your book. And I do want to let people know that you'll be here on June 18th.
And right before we show the first part of the five-hour film, 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor,
Victoria Alexander will be here talking about her book briefly and signing books for people, so you can pick up a copy there. Victoria Alexander, thank you so much for being on the show today, and I look forward to meeting you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
And again, you just heard an interview with author Victoria N. Alexander discussing her new book, Locus Amenus. To learn more about Victoria and her new book, the website is victorianalexander.com. And as previously mentioned, on Thursday, June 18th, we'll be showing the first part of the five-hour film, 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor. And Victoria Alexander will be joining us for a brief discussion of her book and a book signing. And again, that's all going to happen on Thursday, June 18th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And I'm going to end the show today with a song by Eva James called Sharing the Truth About 9/11. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
It's absolutely essential that Americans understand the truth about 9/11.
One day in Manhattan, clear as could be, till the planes hit the buildings and changed history. They stood for an hour. Once the damage was done, but then suddenly crumbled. 10 seconds they were gone. There were cascading projections of steel into dust. Looked like explosions, but it was not discussed. So I turn off the TV, shut out the lights. It's all just illusion right in front of my eyes. Well, I'm not scared of dying. We're all bound for heaven. I'm just sharing the truth about 9/11. Now building number 7, drop the cleanest of all, yet the world still knows nothing of this amazing free fall. There was no real reason, it wasn't hit by a plane. They say it was a fire, yet you can't see the flame. See cascading projections of steel into dust. Looks like demolition, but it's never discussed. So I turn off the TV and shut out the lights. It's all just illusion right in front of my eyes. Scared of dying, we're all bound for heaven, just sharing the truth about 9/11. They say that the bigger the lie, the more people believe, and the deeper the fear, the more easily we are deceived. I'm sharing the truth about 9/11.